With us, we're glad you're with us. If you have been given one of those little blue folders with a little welcome card, a visitor card in there, please feel free to please fill it out and hand it to one of the men. We'll be glad to follow up with you, answer any questions you have. Last time I was here, it was actually in November of last year, the part one of this lesson, and this is actually part two. In 1 Peter 3:15. We have the scripture that says, "But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense to anyone who asks of you the reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear." As it says in 1 Peter 3:15, we need to be ready to give an apology, which is what the word there means. That's where the word apologetics come from. And we need to be able to give people the reason for the hope that's in us. And sometimes, I don't know about you, but sometimes I like to have not just the Word of God to rely on. I like to have other things because God gives us other things to help us have faith in Him. And so one of the reasons for this series is not only to help you talk to other people about what's the reason for the faith that's in you, but help build up your own faith too. We're on this teleological argument. The last time we talked about that, it's the argument from design. Prior to this, we did God's own defense of His existence, and He did that, and you can read about it in Isaiah chapter 43, 44, 45, where He proves that He's God by prophecy. We talked about the cosmological argument, which is the argument of cause and effect, which says the universe is here, therefore it either must be eternal or something, or it had to have created itself, or something had to have created it. And, of course, the natural conclusion to that, if you looked at the laws of physics and all that, is that the universe was created. The teleological argument is the argument from design. And that argument says that if there is design evident in things, then there must have been a designer. We talked about this last time. I'm going to throw this slide up here again because some people say, well, why do we talk about science in a Bible class or in a sermon? And the reason is because God gives us permission to do that. God has used, in fact, God says, if you look at the slide, God uses two different ways to talk to us. On the one, on the left-hand side, you see natural revelation. That's in Psalm 19, verses 1 through 4, where it said, "The heavens declare the glory of God." God speaking us through the heavens. If you go out at night, in fact, if you haven't gone out at night, I would say just waiting until it gets less rainy. But if you go out at night and there are no clouds in the sky and the full moon rises up and the stars are out, and just soak that in, you can see the glory of God in the night sky. You can see the glory of God in the day sky. You can see Him in the mountains. You can see Him in the trees. You can see Him in the animals. You can see God everywhere. Except downtown Seattle. I don't see much God down in downtown Seattle because it was just there. Concrete and buildings everywhere. I don't know. No, He's down there too. But He says, in verse 3, it says, there is no speech nor language, for their voice is not heard. And of course, in Romans 1, in verses 19 and 20, it says, "God has manifested them, for God has shown it to them, for since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen." God says, outside of the Bible, that He is, and that He is God, and that He is the one that's all-powerful. We can see that in natural revelation. On the right-hand side, we see this idea of special revelation. That's where God talks to us through His Word. And you can see the different scriptures up there, like 2 Peter 1, verse 20 and 21. Verse 21 says, "But holy men of God spoke as they were moved by the Holy Spirit." We can see in Hebrews that God, who at various times spoke to the fathers by the prophets, as in this last days has spoken to us by His Son. That's specific revelation. That's the Bible. God speaks to us in these both ways. And if you look at, and if you want some Bible ideas for allowing us to speak to others about science and stuff like that, look at Mars Hill, Paul on Mars Hill, when he starts off talking about nature and about God and nature, and then go to Acts 14 when they want to sacrifice to Him as Zeus. And how does he start off his conversation? He doesn't say, "No, you shouldn't worship false idols. Thou shalt not, worship." He doesn't quote the Ten Commandments to him. He talks about nature. He starts talking about nature. Paul does that, so we can do that. So if this helps your own faith, great. But if it helps you speak to someone else, that's great too, because God gives us permission to do that. Again, we have the teleological argument, which states where there is purposeful design, there must be a designer. And you can see that, you can see last time we talked about the universe, we talked about our solar system, we talked about the incredible odds that the universe could be created, could have created by itself because of the design. The design in here is better than any 747, right? The minute tolerances that are necessary for the universe to even exist cry out that there's a designer. And if the universe shows purposeful design, then there must have been a designer. And it does. So what's the answer to that? There must have been a designer. Well, this time we're going to look at nature and see some of that. But again, we want to talk about William Paley just for a second. He's the one that came up with this idea called the watchmaker argument. And what he says is, if you were walking through the forest and you came upon a watch and picked it up, you wouldn't think that that thing just happened. You could open it up and you could see the gears and stuff. And I made the comment last time, many of you have probably not even seen the inside of a watch because you have phones or Casios or whatever. But this is what an old style watch looked like. And all those gears click at a certain time and they keep time. And he said, if you looked at that, you wouldn't think that that just existed, that just happened, that through chance that came together. You would see that someone had to have made that. Now, there was another man in that time period whose name was Charles Darwin, and his theory of evolution and his discussion, the book that he wrote, was mainly in opposition to William Paley's discussion of the watchmaker argument. So we're going to talk a little bit about Darwin today as we go on. Hebrews chapter 3, verses 3 said, "He who built the house has more honor than the house, for every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God." What this is saying is that this is actually an argument of cause and effect. The house is the effect. The universe is the effect. The human body is the effect. The cause is God. If the universe is the effect, the cause is God. And you can see that in this case, the house is the effect and the builder is the cause. And you can see that in this argument, in this scripture here, that God is the cause of the effects. And you can see that he is an antecedent to it and stuff like that. But the whole point of this is that God is actually the one who is the designer. We can see that. But not everyone sees that. So I want to just break into this idea of intelligent design now for a while. And if you have a chance, I'm going to spend about 15 minutes on a couple of slides that Bill spent about 8 weeks on. Now, that either means I'm a much better teacher than he is, or he did it a lot better than I'm going to do. I'm not going to do this justice at all. And I'm only going to talk about really two examples of intelligent design. Well, three. And so if you really want to get immersed in this, go watch his class or go listen to his class, because he's got some incredible videos and stuff that I'm only going to show a picture of. Like I said, we're going to talk about this idea, but before we do that, I want to talk about, the question is intelligent design the same as creationism? Now, a person who's an atheist, a person who doesn't believe in intelligent design, they're going to say they're the same thing. But intelligent design people will tell you that creationism is not intelligent design. And there's a reason for that, and you need to be aware of that when you're looking at intelligent design arguments and stuff like that. Let's see. Intelligent design people believe that there's a designer. This is the main difference. But they refuse to name the designer. Creationists will say, well, of course there's a designer, and it's Jehovah God. But an intelligent design person who's a scientist and who's looking into the way things work and all that, they think that saying who the designer is a totally separate discussion from the idea of design. They want to divorce themselves from that for a very good reason, because they want intelligent design to be science and not religion. And so if someone asks you, is intelligent design religion, you can say no. And here's a quote. Here's a quote, and I believe this is by Michael Behe. I could be wrong, but he said, intelligent design refers to the scientific research program, as well as the community of scientists, philosophers, and other scholars who seek evidence of design in nature. That's all they're looking for. They're looking for design. They're not looking for who made it. They're just looking for design. The theory of intelligent design holds that certain features of the universe and of living things are best explained by intelligent cause, not by undirected process such as natural selection. In other words, they're going to say, look at the eye. That thing couldn't have been just naturally evolved over time. They're saying it had to have been created. It's got a design part to it. And of course, the Darwinists are going to come back and say, no, they're wrong. That could have been created. That could have been evolved. But they're looking for certain features that are best explained by intelligent design. That's their argument, is that there's a designer. And so you can go through and read this. Through the study of analysis of a system's components, a design theorist is able to determine whether various natural structures are the product of chance, natural law, intelligent design, or some combination thereof. Such research is conducted by observing the types of information produced when intelligent designs act. Let's skip down to the next part down here. It says, intelligent design has been applied to these scientific methods. And keep in mind, that's what an intelligent design scientist would say, is that they're using scientific method. They're scientists. They're not religionists. To detect design in irreducibly complex biological structures, the complex and specified information content in DNA, the life-sustaining physical architecture of the universe, and the geologically rapid origin of biological diversity in the fossil record during the Cambrian explosion approximately 530 million years ago. So is a creationist, is an intelligent designer a creationist? Well, this last statement should tell you that they're not. If I were to look at that, I would say they're talking about theistic evolution, right? That, or guided evolution. They're saying that God, through his power and whatever, guided these changes during the Cambrian explosion 530 million years ago. So are intelligent designers creationists? No, they're not. But that doesn't mean that we can't use their information that shows design in our arguments for creationism. Here's a quote, though. It's actually from Roger Ebert. You know who Roger Ebert was, right? He was a film critic. And someone was asking him about this idea of panspermia in the movie Prometheus. And if you've seen the movie Prometheus, the beginning of it shows you a guy who sacrifices himself and basically dumps himself onto a pure earth, and his body breaks down and becomes all life on earth. It's kind of an interesting, it's really actually a cool thing CGI-wise and all that, but it's totally bogus. He says, this is a quote from Roger Ebert. He says, intelligent design is the disguise by which creationists are attempting to infiltrate American schoolrooms and textbooks with their theology. I have no problem at all that they believe God created the heavens, the earth, and man on the seventh day he rested. They can believe, they can even believe that this happened around 10,000 years ago, as about 46% of Americans do. What I object to is the fraudulent science by which they attempt to smuggle this religion into classrooms. A biblical explanation for creation no more belongs in a textbook than any other creation myth, such as Native American belief that we were all given birth by the Earth Mother with Spider Woman acting as a midwife. Now that ID, or intelligent design, has been thoroughly debunked, the tactics has shifted to teach the controversy. In science, there's no controversy. Roger Ebert. Now, the thing is that he's saying several things here that you should get at. He's saying that he calls intelligent design creation the same. You'll find that argument all over the internet. He's saying that it's fraudulent science, and he's saying that it's been thoroughly debunked. And at least three of those statements are wrong. Right, it hasn't been debunked, or it wouldn't still be happening. thoroughly debunked, anyway. It's not the same thing as creationism. So that's what you're going to be up against when you talk about this sort of stuff, when you look it up on the internet and stuff like that. But it also mentions in the last slide this idea of irreducible complexity. And this is in the book Darwin's Black Box. Michael Behe kind of coins this idea, this term, irreducible complexity. And that means that you get to a point in a machine or something like that, that if you take away one part, that machine is not going to work. And so he actually is going to use this idea of a mousetrap to explain that. But also in his book, that's how he starts the explanation. And then he talks about the eye, and then he talks about flagellum, bacterial flagellum. They're little motorboats. And so the thing to look at here is that you're always, if you look up intelligent design, especially in the realms of biology, you're almost always going to run into this concept. And what he says is that a single system, which is composed of several interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, and where the removal of any of one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning, that's irreducible complexity. And the reason he called his book Darwin's Black Box is because Darwin's got several black boxes in his thinking, and one of those black boxes is the eye. Because in Darwin's time, You look at the eye. They knew what the eye was. They could cross-section the eye. They could see how the eye might have worked, but they couldn't actually explain how the eye worked. They didn't have the necessary biochemical knowledge that Behe has, and Behe is actually a biochemical scientist. And so he calls it Darwin's black box because Darwin says, well, the eye just evolved. We can see that. And without understanding the systems that go into vision. But again, the way he explains it is this mousetrap here. And so this mousetrap has a base, and it has a catch, and it has a hold down bar, it has a spring, and it has the hammer. I didn't realize this was called the hammer, but I guess they put the hammer down on mice. But so he's saying that, and you can visualize a mousetrap. Any of you who've ever set a mousetrap, could you imagine it not having a catch? That's the thing where you put the cheese, right? Or the peanut butter. Peanut butter works better than cheese. So that if you didn't have a catch, how are you going to hold that hold down bar down? You're just supposed to hold it there, wait until a mouse comes in. Without that catch, the mouse trap doesn't work. Without the base to hold all this stuff, it wouldn't work. Without the hammer, if you didn't have a spring, the hammer would just sit there. The mouse could eat the cheese or the peanut butter all day. So you can see that if you take any one of these parts out of here, it's no longer a mouse trap. Now, someone will come by and say, well, yeah, I used a mouse trap without a hammer and everything to launch spitballs in class, but it's not a mouse trap. You know, it's a base with a hammer and a spring on it. It's not a mousetrap. And so the idea is that without any one of these parts, Behe says, it is not a mousetrap. So it's irreducibly complex. You have to have those to have this type of mousetrap. So now you could have a mousetrap that's just made out of sticky paper. That's not saying the same thing. But if you had the paper without the stick, you know, the sticky part, it wouldn't be a mousetrap, right? It would just be a piece of paper. If you had the sticky part without the paper, it wouldn't be a mousetrap. So it still works out that way. So he gives this mousetrap example. And likewise, he's going to assert that natural selection could not create from scratch the information, the way this works, because the selectable function is only present when all parts are assembled. It's only a mousetrap when everything's there. It's only an eye when you have the retina and the macula and the cones and rods and the lens and the all the stuff I'm going to talk about in just a second. It's only an eye, and it only works like a camera when all that's present. And so without some of those, without the retina in your eye, without the macula, without the optic nerve, without all the biochemical stuff that goes on behind it, it's not going to work. So what purpose does it serve in natural selection? And that's what Darwin's all about, is that something mutated on an animal or creature of some kind that gave it a better way to survive, and so it was naturally selected. That's what natural selection is all about. And without that, it doesn't work. And so let's talk about the eye. But before we talk about, well, we're going to talk about the eye. Before we talk about what Behe's going to say about the eye, let's talk about what a Darwinist would say about an eye. And so you can see on the left here, you can see that, and this is basically Darwin's argument, is that some tiny creatures have pigmented cells that have photoreceptors in them, and it helps them survive. And he says that he gives some example. I can't remember the exact example. The next example where an animal has a slightly concave thing, which gives them better reception. They say starfish have this kind of an eye. Where they have pigmented cells inside a concave thing. But what he's saying is that over time, then that got deeper and deeper until that little opening, which gives it better field of view because you can see a better angles, but it's a smaller field of view, that then it needs something else, and then it fills with this transparent fluid here, and then it fills, and then because that wasn't enough, it had to develop something to keep the fluid in, which is a kind of a clear patch of skin over that. And you can see Darwin looks around and says, I see a starfish looks like this, and I see this looks like this. And he says, these show in nature that all these things could have existed. And so, and then he says it developed a lens, it developed the cornea, it developed all sorts of, you know, the rest of the stuff, the iris, the retina, all that stuff is in, he says those could have developed over time. And he's taking a simplistic view of all these things because he doesn't know what's going on in the eye. And what Behe says, because they've been researching this for so long, is that that how the eye really works is like this: is that light comes in, and there's actually over the lens here is a thin veil of tears. So you've got tear ducts that actually keep your eye lubricated, right? And that thin veil of tears has a natural disinfectant in it to keep the eye from getting infected. So the light comes in, it goes through that, it's very thin, it goes through the cornea, which is transparent. Could you imagine if your eyes didn't have a transparent, it'd be like Paul, right, when scales fell from his eyes, it'd be that kind of a thing. It goes through the iris and the retina, and the retina is great because if you've ever looked at yourself in a bright light, your retina gets really small, right, because it's trying to limit the amount of light that comes into your eye. Or if it's in a dark situation, your eyes get really big because it's trying to allow as much light as possible to come into your eye. That function alone is incredible, isn't it? Where the eye actually will change the aperture based on the amount of light that's out there. It's incredible. Then it goes through the lens, which focuses it. Now, Sandy and I and a couple of others don't have this anymore. They actually went in there and they stirred it around, sucked it out, and they put a fake lens in there. So, which is kind of nice because now I have better vision. It goes through this called the vitreous humor, which is a clear liquid, until it hits the retina in the back of the eye, and it's covering the back of the eye, and especially in the one place which is called the macula. Have you ever heard of macular degeneration? That's when the macula starts getting bad and falling away from the retina and stuff. And then, what's happening through all of this though is that when light hits these photoreceptors, it binds with a certain, the photons bind with a certain protein, and this is just crazy, and it does something else, and there are like 10 different incredible chemical reactions that happen before an electrical stimulus is sent down the optic nerve, and then your brain, the vision center of your brain says, oh, I see a tree, or I see Bill, or I see Jack, or, you know, that's what it's saying. And what Behe is saying is that what Darwin didn't know is that these simple systems that he's looking at are horribly, horribly complex. That with and all of those parts have to be there before the eye will work. I mean, you could have a lens, you could have all of the stuff in there, but if the chemical reactions, these chemical reactions that are just now beginning to understand, if those chemical reactions didn't take place, then you would not have vision. You could have all the parts there, but not have vision just because of that. So Behe is saying the eye is irreducibly complex. And you can go on the internet again and look up intelligent design in the eye or irreducibly complex in the eye. You'll see half a dozen things saying, oh yeah, we've already proved that that's wrong. But they really haven't proved that it's wrong. They just go back to this tired old explanation and say, well, it could have happened this way. They don't prove that it's happened that way. They say it could have happened this way. And so what they try to do is they try to cast doubt on this idea of irreducible complexity. So the eye is probably one of the better examples of it. Again, Behe says the eye is a structure that could not have evolved. Its ability to provide vision depends on the perfect arrangements of its parts. Natural selection could never favor the transitional forms needed during the eye's evolution. So, you know, what good is half an eye? You have to have all the parts there for it to work. So it's irreducibly complex. Another one that we wanted to look at is this idea of the bacterial flagellum. This is, Dan, you should appreciate this. This is a motor and a drive shaft and a clutch and a propeller. Well, maybe you won't because you work on cars. Bill, you would really appreciate this because this is a boat. Right? It's got its own propeller. This is, now, you look at this, and you look at this, it's got a stator, it's got a clutch, it's got rings, it's got, actually the next picture is better. Let's pull the trigger and get the next picture here. It's actually talking about it. It's got the engine, it's got the drive unit's always spinning in one of these things. And it can spin both directions, actually. And not only that, it can go 100,000 revolutions per minute. You know, that's really fast, right? And yet, in a quarter of a turn at 100,000 revolutions a minute, it can put the brakes on and turn around and go backwards. It can spin it the other way. We don't even have motors that can do that now. So so it's got its own U-joint here, and the, of course, the flagellum, actually the propeller out there. So this is like off of an E. coli bacteria or something. They've gone down and they've looked at this at the microscopic level, and they've seen that all of this stuff is in here. Now, what happens if you have an engine with no camshaft? You got pistons that can go like this all day long, right? But if there's, can they do that? They can't do that because there's no camshaft to drive the pistons, right? Or what if they had a camshaft but no pistons? Or what if they had an engine with no clutch? You know, we're talking manual transmission here. You people who drive automatics wouldn't know this, but what if they had an automatic with no gear shift? You know, you can imagine all the stuff that's going in here, and this is all made of organic parts. These are all parts that are created not like in a car, not like in a, you know, smart car, which is really small, but these are microscopically small parts. Can you imagine being a mechanic working on one of these? And yet they do that. That's what gene splicing and therapy and stuff does. But the idea is that this unit, if you took away any of those parts, would not function. It's irreducibly complex. And Behe spends a lot of time talking about this. And the idea is that this is also all chemicals and proteins and all the stuff that goes on in a cell. And without, if you take away any one of these parts, it would not work as the outboard motor for a bacterium. It's irreducibly complex. And an evolutionist would then have to say, can you imagine trying to answer that argument? How did this evolve? Well, it evolves a clutch, but it doesn't have a motor. But somehow that clutch gets it to the next stage where it's able to breed better than the other bacterium that don't have clutches. But then one of them develops a motor, and of course they wanted the only way this will work in that time is to spread out the time frame to billions of years, and so the and that's only if you have incredibly good luck with the incredible odds that go. So you have this idea, this irreducible complexity, and it's an incredible argument that you can use to say that this stuff didn't just happen. If there is design, there is what? A designer. And who is that designer? Well, we understand that it's Jehovah God. It's the God of heaven, all-powerful God, and he's the one that designed all of this stuff. And that actually speaks to, if you think about the diversity in nature and how all things are, sure, most birds work the same way. They have wings and stuff. But there, how many species of birds are there out there? And each one of them looks different. They're different species. And God made all that. And why did he make all that? Because the heavens declare the glory of God and the earth and the firmament also, right? He made it out there so that we would be without an excuse, is the idea. One of the places that I want to talk about just briefly is this idea of math in nature. There's a guy named Fibonacci, and let's see, do I have his name on here? I can't remember his first name. I think it's John, but I could be wrong. I don't have his name. It's this Fibonacci series, and what he decided to do is he sat around. This is what people do in the 1800s, I guess. They just sit around and think about rabbits reproducing. But he said that if you had two rabbits, and they had two rabbits, and then they had four rabbits, and he started thinking about this. And if you start off, the Fibonacci sequence is this down here. It's actually zero. 0 plus 1 is 1. 1 plus 1 is 2. 1 plus 2 is 3, 2 plus 3 is 5, 5 plus 3 is 8. If you notice, they're just adding the prior number to the sequence, and you can go through all the way up, and the sequence gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Of course, this Fibonacci sequence actually goes on forever. But this Fibonacci sequence that he named, that was named after him, is actually seen all through nature. It's a design aspect that's seen that's everywhere in nature. Here's it's represented in squares. So you see this tiny square here? Two of those squares equals that. Two of those squares equals that. Two of those squares equals that. Equals that, equals that, equals that, equals that, equals that, right? Now, if you start with this formula down here, A plus B divided by A equals A divided by B, and this is called phi. It's the Greek letter phi. It actually ends up being this number right here, this ratio right here, 1.61803. And that's called the golden ratio. And you can see that not only, actually artists use it all the time. I'm going to make a bookcase at home that's going to have a file cabinet underneath it. And I was trying to figure out how to make it as pleasing as possible to the eye. And so I figured out that I need to make it in this shape right here, right? Small cabinet underneath and a big bookcase on top. And to make it pleasing to the eye. They did that with the Parthenon. They did that with, you find it in art all over the place. But the reason you find it in art and everything else is because, and you find it in the Great Pyramids, you find it in, you can find it everywhere. The reason is because God created this sequence. He built this sequence into nature. And it's incredible the way you see it. This spiral here, if you start in the center and go to the corners of each of these and arc it out like that, at the corner of each opposite side. Does anyone recognize that spiral? You see it actually everywhere in nature is the thing. You see it in the nautilus shell. It's just right there. You see it in this cacti right here, right? You can see that it kind of goes out, and they go out in spirals like that. You see it actually multiple times in the sunflower seeds here. And part of that's because it's the easiest way to pack the most seeds into the right area. But you can see these spirals going out like that. They're all following the Fibonacci sequence. This cauliflower here, it's kind of like it's got a special name. I can't remember. But it's hard to see, but you can see that each one of those, it's going out in a spiral. It's the Fibonacci sequence. It's all through nature. If you divide the ratio into 360 degrees, you find out that it's 137.5 degrees. A lot of plants, when they're growing up, their leaves go out at 137 degrees going up around the stalk of the plant. Or you'll see that when a tree goes up, first you have, you know, one branch, and then you have two branches, then you have it goes up in a Fibonacci sequence. God has built design into nature that's just incredible. And this is just one number and one ratio and all of that. It's all through nature. So if you see this kind of design in nature, what's your natural conclusion? There's a designer. And the designer is Jehovah God. So again, some pretty cool stuff. I think I have everything here. Last time we ended with these quotes by two men who started off as atheists and ended up as God believers. Anthony Flew believes more of a deist type of a thing, but he goes from being an absolute atheist who's carrying the banner of atheism to being a person who believes that there is a designer and that God was a designer. And the reason he does that is because of DNA. We didn't even talk about DNA, but DNA is so complex. And with just a tiny bit, you could contain as much information as the Library of Congress. DNA is that powerful, that complex, and that's what convinced Anthony Flew that there had to have been a designer. Fred Hoyle's the one that came up with the idea of the tornado in a junkyard, is that you don't have a tornado that go through a junkyard and have it leave behind an intact and working 747. It just doesn't happen that way. And he's the one that says a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to be so overwhelming as to put the conclusion beyond question. The odds that we just happened, talking about the eye, I forgot to mention, they think that the human eye evolved over time. The problem is that there are 30 some different classifications of eyes. That would mean that the eye would have to independently evolve 30 different times. The odds that the eye would evolve once, and what that's saying is that there's no common ancestor for all these different types of eyes. The odds that the eye would evolve once are incredible. The odds that they would evolve 30 different times are uber incredible. I mean, you just can't measure that kind of probability. What's an atheist or Darwinist answer to that? Well, the odds are really good, but incredibly bad, but it just happened. You know, I personally would rather believe that God created all these things. Psalm 14:1 says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So don't be a fool, right? Again, Romans 1:19 says, because what may be known of God is manifest to them, for God has shown it to them, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen. Psalm 139, verse 14, I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. The human body is a great machine, but it was designed. It didn't just happen. So the conclusion is again, why do you want to have this sort of weapon in your arsenal? Because God allows you to do it. God allows you to use science to prove, you can't actually prove God with science, to prove that God, there is a God. God has left incredible evidence for us to look at. Whether you try to shake up a bag of Legos and form something out of it, or, you know, like Terry had Riley come up and try to do, do the same thing with straw in a bird's nest or whatever, it just doesn't happen. You have to actually put it in use. So that's the lesson for today. If you want more information on Behe's black box and all the chemical reactions that go along with it, I suggest that you go check out the book from the library or something. So, Bill, you have a song for us. I'm glad that you could be here. If you have needs that you need to make known to the congregation, whether it's to put Jesus on in baptism or to repent of sin or whatever, come forward as we stand and sing.